Hello, good afternoon. I'd like to offer some thoughts and reflections. And these, we've been emphasising continuity of practice, and these talks are also an opportunity to continue our practice of feeling our contact with the ground, being with the body and breath, and also of listening and speaking, in my case. And a real invitation to see this again as an opportunity to notice the movements of the mind and heart. What feels, what your interest is drawn to or away from, what lands, what doesn't. The sounds coming and going, as well as the breath coming and going in the body. Sometimes when we are listening and also speaking, we can lose touch with that, the ground, the contact with the earth, with the support. That's a bit of a reminder to me as well. So how are you doing? Been here nearly 24 hours, around 24 hours. How's it going? And maybe it feels like this 24 hours have been the longest 24 hours of your life. Maybe it's like years and years have gone by, centuries. Or maybe, you know, time has shrunk and there's been times when you've sat down. It feels like a few moments pass and then the bell rings and it's like, oh, was that really half an hour, 45 minutes? And time can do very strange things on retreat. We can really see how, you know, it's a concept and our relationship to it is quite fluid often. And often it's very usual in this first day of retreat that we will encounter some of the momentum of our lives that's kind of still taking us forward, still the kind of wheels turning, the body, mind, heart. We might feel a lot of tiredness that we're bringing with us from our lives. Restlessness, perhaps, physical discomfort, all the kind of aches and pains in the body that we were kind of a bit aware of or not really aware of, really like showing up. Kind of, wah. Or perhaps different emotions, different feelings, different mind states also like suddenly clamouring for attention now that there is more space, more quietness. Perhaps there's some calm, some opening, some unexpected things, some surprise. Some things that we're noticing that feel new. Unfamiliar. So one of the potential gifts of being somewhat secluded and closer to ourselves without our usual daily demands and distractions is that there can be these moments of surprise, these shifts in perspective, moments of clarity. And there can also be a lot of, what am I doing here? And what's this all about? And who are these people? And what is this place? And have I made the right decision? And like real uncertainty and doubt and confusion. How do we find some steadiness with all of this? And in a lot of the practices today, we're emphasizing this tuning to the ground, the breath, the body, keeping things simple, letting things land, like the image of a glass of cloudy, freshly pressed apple juice where all the bits are kind of fizzing around and then just slowly, slowly things start to settle and things clarify. But yes, we might well be asking, is it okay to be here? Is it okay to be myself here? Do I belong? Where can I plant my roots? Can I put my roots down here? So I wanted to offer some reflections on this theme of refuge and belonging. Some questions that I am mulling over and continue to mull over in my life, in my practice. This longing to belong, a longing to belong, to really know and take my place on this earth. To put aside what the teacher and writer, psychologist Tara Brach calls the trance of unworthiness. The trance of unworthiness. It's just a trance. It veils, it clouds. Can I trust that underneath that I can tune and tap in more and more to yes, this is my birthright. My birthright of being here, taking my place. My birthright of the possibility of awakening, whatever that means. The possibility of continuing to ask questions that lead me forward, that continue to open doors, that continue to bring fresh insights into what it means to be on this human, impermanent, often unsatisfactory, sometimes very impersonal journey. Can all these questions be explored with deep, deep kindness and infinite patience? So often, traditionally, at the beginning of a period of practice, there is a practice of taking refuge. And traditionally, in the Buddhist way of thinking, it's taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. That'll be familiar to some of you and not to others. And there's different ways that we can look at this. The Buddha, Buddho literally means to wake up, the one who has woken up. Could be those who inspire us, our role models, those who encourage us. The Dharma, the body of teachings of wisdom and compassion, a path of flourishing and thriving that leads onwards. That doesn't see itself as the only way by any means, but one where we can deepen and learn to trust our own potential. And Sangha, literally a circle. Community, somewhere where we can acknowledge our humanity, our shared vulnerability, our joys and sorrows. And one sense of taking refuge, as I understand it, is really to broaden and deepen out our sense of self. So we're taking refuge in something that includes ourselves, but that is also wider and deeper. And more than just ourselves. There's a story in the traditional teachings of the Buddha touching the earth. And the statue here is the Buddha in this gesture, this mudra of the hand touching the earth. And this happens in the midst of onslaughts of doubt and despair. The figure in the traditional teachings called Mara, Mara, M-A-R-A. And from our 21st century perspective, we could see that as psychological. We could see it as those questions of doubt and self-negation and despair and berating that can be some of the landscape of our mind and heart. And Mara comes to the Buddha and questions, who do you think you are? Who on earth do you think you are to undertake this path, to set your sights towards awakening, towards this path of flourishing? And the Buddha doesn't respond in words. They simply touch the earth. They call on the earth to bear witness. To bear witness to their birthright. I am here. I am here. Human, and more than human perhaps. Their right to go as far as they are able in their human and spiritual journey. And this sense of touching the earth, as we've been emphasizing today, this contact, the foot on the ground, lifting, moving, placing. The backside on the chair, cushion, the legs, the feet on the ground. Supported by this unconditional presence of the earth beneath us, in whatever way we understand that. So three more aspects of this sense of broadening and deepening into what is greater than us. I wanted to just pick up on three. Firstly, a sense of our ancestors or lineages in all senses of the word, and that will be very different for all of us. There'll be different realms of lineage and ancestry that are important. But I wanted to pick up on, because of this being the Rainbow Dharma Retreat for this community, the sense of our LGBTQ plus lineages. And I want to also recognise that for many of us that might seem like, yeah, not really anything that feels relevant or important, and it might well be that, you know, for you the sense of LGBTQ identity and community has maybe felt double-edged. That question of, do I belong here? Maybe experiences of really not feeling that you belong, or feeling excluded, or feeling, yeah, in many different ways that you have not been welcomed. Maybe you feel very new. It's like, well, I'm just on this journey of coming out, and I don't know how it's going to be, and I don't know the terminology, and it's all a bit strange, and I'm feeling my way. And there can be many ways in which Mara shows up in this context as well to say, who do you think you are? Can we notice Mara? Can we see Mara? This is what happens when Mara comes along to the Buddha and other practitioners, that when Mara is seen and acknowledged and recognized, then its force dissipates and it leaves. Perhaps, as I say, community has other resonances for you, that, you know, family is also important, your biological family, your logical family, as people say. But I just wanted to really tell a story of something that has resonated with me in this context. A few years ago, I had the good fortune to be part of a project collecting and documenting stories of LGBTQ lives in Sheffield, the city that I lived in then. And as part of this, as a writer, I was invited to have open workshops with anybody who wanted to come along to talk about and write about their lives. And all of this material then was put together in a performance with song and visuals and photos and videos and lots of things that we did. And it was part of, was supported by the History Department at Sheffield University. So in these workshops, people came along and shared, you know, amazing range really of stories of their lives, of their challenges, of all kinds of things. And often, because it had been billed as like LGBTQ activism, there was this question of like, I'm not an activist. You know, people would come with that very much like, who am I? I'm not an activist. I haven't, you know, I'm not one for marches or demonstrations or this or political activity or anything like that. So that was often the case, that people would sort of like precede what they said with that kind of comment. And this was the case with this particular man, and the story is in the public domain, so I'm able to share it with you. I'm not going to name him, but it's been documented and it's now in the LGBT history archive in Sheffield. So he came along, and he was a man who'd come out in the late 60s, the 1960s. You know, at a time when it was still criminalised to be a gay man. And he'd been through many challenges. He was a working class man from Sheffield, and he had a job as a bin man, driving the lorries and collecting the rubbish from people's houses, and that's what he did. And it got out, word got out, or he came out, got out around among his work colleagues that he was gay. And they started to mock him. He said he would come into work and there would be, like, you know, wigs on his locker or a handbag, or, you know, words of abuse, or, you know, this or that. And so it was a tough time. And what he decided to do was actually to, you know, in my view, take this tremendously courageous act. What he did was he had a badge made, said Union of Gay Bin Men. And he wore this badge, and he was like, this is who I am. This is the early 1970s in Sheffield. And so that's what he did. He was who he was, and he continued like that. And he said slowly over time, things changed. And his work colleagues started to change their views. And having been, you know, he'd been ostracized, nobody wanted to work with him, alongside him. Over time, people really started to, like, want to work alongside him. He was great at what he did. He was a good worker. He was really efficient. And, you know, they were like, actually, this guy is great at what he does. And we're going to be alongside him. We're going to be his colleagues. So he donated this badge to the LGBT History Archive, and it is there now. And so he told this story, and he was like, but I'm not an activist. I was like, hang on a minute. This is one of the most courageous acts that I have heard. And just, you know, telling that story to you today, I get again, you know, I remember him, and I remember that kind of him telling this story so much, much better than I could. And how much inspiration that gave me, and how much, you know, how much I borrowed from that courage, and how much we can kind of fuel ourselves from the stories. Maybe they're LGBT stories, maybe they're not, maybe they're from lots of other lineages, lots of other identities, lots of other parts of our identity. People who have before us, in so many ways, undocumented, unresearched, untold, have lived their lives with courage, with determination, with great bravery and care, and made it possible for us to live our lives too. So that is one way, that one thing that we can tap into, that we can feel into, a sense of not being alone. You know, and sometimes on retreat we can feel very alone. We can feel like, you know, it's just me walking up and down, going to sit, doing my job, eating my food. You know, things can get really contracted in, so it can feel like, you know, just in this thing, and, you know, a lot of tension can build up. Can we spread, can we broaden out the vertical, the horizontal, into what is not just me, not just myself, not just mine? So the second story picks up more from the Buddhist tradition and from the lineage of practitioners, the lineage of people over 2,500 years who have done what we're doing here. And I wanted to tell you the story of Bhikkhuni Soma. So Bhikkhuni is the Pali word for nun. And these stories of the nuns are actually, they have their own section in the Pali canon, and they're really wonderful stories that give us an insight into these women who practiced, of course, in a very patriarchal setup with many, many struggles and challenges, but who had, you know, great determination and courage and took the robes and, went forth. And this Bhikkhuni Soma, the story goes that she sat down at the foot of a tree for the day's meditation. Then Mara, so often the translation goes the evil one. This is a kind of, you know, devil, a Buddhist demon, desiring to make her fearful, desiring to arouse trepidation and terror in her, and to make her fall away from her meditation, approaches her and addresses her, and says, kind of, who do you think you are? Awakening is so hard to achieve. It can only be achieved by the wise ones. It can't be attained by a woman with her two-fingered wisdom. There's a lot of debate about what this two-fingered wisdom means. Is it like tiny amount, like with two fingers? Some translations is like, the wisdom of a woman is only good for like testing grains of rice to see if they're cooked or not. But whatever, it's really derogatory, and going straight to her feminine, female identity. Who do you think you are? And Soma replied, well, first of all, she says, who is this? You know, is it a human? Is it a non-human? It's Mara. And this is what she responds. What does a fixed identity matter when the mind is clear and knowledge flows on steadily? When we fixate on anything, we make ourselves vulnerable to reactivity and stress. So this is interesting, isn't it, for our exploration of identity, and what is more than identity. And she really points to this sense, you know, if when we fixate, and maybe we found ourselves doing this today, like that shoulder pain that is unbearable and I just can't stand it, and, you know, the stories kind of spill out, you know, never going to be able to move, I'm going to, you know, maybe I need this or that, medical help, you know, and of course we need to take care of our bodies, we need to listen to them, but we can feel that, and maybe it's a particular, you know, other emotion in the body or a thought, a mind state, you know, I can't stand the way they do the washing up here. It's like, you know, if I was in charge, I would do this and this and this, and we found we've like constructed a whole world of a different washing up scenario. This is just my own particular habit patterns that can emerge sometimes. Maybe very different from yours, but you know, whatever it is, there's something that we can fixating. And in that moment, what happens? We get smaller, we get contracted, we lose fluidity, we lose flexibility, we lose freedom. We lose freedom. We lose the possibility of seeing a range of views, a range of opinions. It's like, no, this view, this opinion. And it's views and opinions, particularly about ourselves, that we can get really the most fixated on. Like, I'm this kind of person. I'm always going to be like this. I'm never going to be like that. I'm better than, worse than, all those kind of things that can emerge. So what happens, the Bhikkhuni Soma recites her verse and Mara realizes that she's seen him. She's gone, seen him, her, them. And sad and disappointed, he slinks away. And, if, you know, these stories are kind of very contracted versions. Some, you know, so it can take long, long periods of time for things like this to kind of come, you know, realize, oh, that's where I got stuck. Ah, that's where I've been, like, fixated. And where can I actually find space with that? So thirdly, a different kind of lineage and belonging. And it's something that I first heard in this hall when I was sitting where you're sitting. And it's this, that all living things have a common ancestor. It's a long time ago, 3.6 billion years. But, you know, scientists used to think that life emerged in different places, you know, simultaneously-ish, give and take a few million years probably. And as I understand it, the latest thinking is that in one place, one, I guess, single-celled organism came into being. Life came into being. And that is our common ancestor. All of us. All living beings. The birds. All living things. The grass. The trees. The flies. The lettuce leaf. Each other. The ones we love. The ones we dislike. The ones we're indifferent to. So I offer that as a potential image or story that can be helpful for us when we get lost, when we get contracted into that aloneness. Belonging to the lineage of life . How can that be helpful for us moment to moment here in our moment to moment life on retreat? In the struggles, the delights, the full spectrum, the full jazz. Bernard gave us this lovely word the other day, the full jazz. The full jazz of pleasant, the pleasant moments, the unpleasant, the neither. When we notice, ah, oh, I've contracted up here, I've tightened up around a physical sensation, thought pattern, view, opinion. The lineage of life, life flowing through me. This life that's being lived and breathed through me in the midst of life. In the midst of life. Another image that can be helpful sometimes is that of the waves and the ocean. You know, all of us, waves that come up, beautiful, unique, unexpected, unpredictable, back into the ocean. Here for, you know, in the grand scheme of 3.6 billion years, just for a flash. Oh, there's a fly. The flies come in to say hi, and part of the lineage of life too. Taking refuge in the lineage of life and in these beautiful grounds and gardens is a lot of it to really connect in with and find in your own way, with your own images, in your own time. Where do I belong? How do I belong? Right here. There are three extraordinary big, well, lots of trees in these grounds that are extraordinary and beautiful, but yesterday I was reconnecting with the three big trees on the front lawn. There's a plane tree and two oak trees. And the, you know, the width, the girth of them, and the, you know, if you haven't had a chance to get up close, really recommend it, just to feel how solid they are. And the plane tree has this beautiful branch that, you know, has come down, and you can actually get really close, and, you know, it's, you know, coming closer to the ground and just feeling the weight of that, the weight of it, the depth of their roots, the leaves. You know, I was looking up going, oh, they're so still, they're so still. And then I realised, actually, no, there was a little bit of movement in the leaves. You know, perhaps it is that aspect of nature, perhaps it's the sound of nature, the sounds. Perhaps for you, the connecting, the belonging, the sense of not being alone is just knowing that when the bell rings for the next sitting and it's the last thing you want to do, the very, very last thing. Resting into the knowledge that others will be showing up to. I know this has been hugely important to me over the years. Like, there's a sense of like this gentle movement towards a meditation hall. I'm just going to become part of that wave flowing, even though, you know, every fibre is screaming no and, oh, you know. And of course, it might be that you want to really attend to your body and your heart, mind, and it's like, no, actually the right thing is to walk or whatever it is. But just that sense of being in something that is larger than myself. And also the awareness that whatever we are experiencing, whatever is happening, someone, probably many people somewhere on this planet are going through the same thing. Remembering them, bringing them into consciousness. Can we feel our roots dig deep into the earth in whatever way, whatever that means to us? And also know that we can expand into the space around us. And I wanted to finish with a couple of quotes. One is from a writer called Joan Sullivan. And I found it on a blog called Climate Cultures, which is writers, artists, creative people responding to the climate catastrophe, the ecological catastrophes. If our species manages to save itself, along with millions of other species with whom we share this blue planet, it will be because of a profound shift in collective consciousness, not scientific facts or statistics. We could start by shifting our thinking about the Anthropocene, that's these times in the geological language. Shifting our thinking about these times as an opportunity to expand our ideas of what is possible. That can mean individual, collective. To embody it as an unquenchable thirst to break free from the chains of fossilized ways of thinking. To embody it as an unquenchable thirst to break free from the chains of fossilized ways of thinking. And finally, a poem by Mary Oliver. It's called Poem of the One World. This morning, the beautiful white heron was floating along above the water, and then into the sky of this, the one world we all belong to, where everything, sooner or later, is a part of everything else. Which thought made me feel, for a little while, quite beautiful myself. So let's pause, breathe together for a few moments in quietness, letting the words settle. the sky of this, the one world we all belong to, where everything, sooner or later, is a part of everything else.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.